battle. Before that, his forces had been sent to fight in the Alliance Civil War, and the burden of merging the diverse groups of fighters into a unified force had fallen on Tarkus Venius. This was different. They were about to head off into deep space, far beyond where any Confederation or Alliance vessel had ever traveled. They would be alone, in a way so profound it scared Baron when it slipped into his thoughts. They had to be able to count on each other, because there would be no one else there if they ran into trouble. Baron looked over at Globus and nodded respectfully. The Palatian was just getting started, he knew. The story would go on for quite some time, through multiple rounds of coffee and after-dinner drinks. So Imperator Venius commanded the right wing to advance. "You're in direct charge of Dauntless's systems and maintenance, and damage control if it comes to that. It's time for you to step up, Commander, to really take control." Anya Fritz was staring at Walt Billings, feeling a little guilty for the hard time she was giving him. Billings was a good officer, one who'd greatly exceeded her initial expectations. He'd been a bit of a clown at one time, one who thought he was funnier than he was. But the realities of combat and the losses of friends and comrades had squeezed the excess levity from him, forged him into a strong officer and a capable one. Billings had learned from her, and he'd become one hell of an engineer in his own right. She was damned proud of him. Not that she'd ever let him know that. "I understand, Captain. I've got everything under control. The teams are organized and ready. The ship is brand new, but we've still run diagnostics on a regular schedule. Plus, it's not like..." Billings let his voice trail off, not finishing what he'd begun to say. She knew what he was thinking, what he'd almost said. The war was over. Dauntless was heading off on an exploratory mission. There was a creepy spookiness to plunging into the heart of the Dead Empire, but the ship's engineers weren't likely to face anything like the desperate attempts to restore systems in the middle of battle. If things went well, she and her people would spend most of their time researching old tech finds.
"Perhaps we should put that to the test, Commander. I think we'll run some simulated damage drills, then we'll see just how quickly your people can do their jobs."
Fritz was edgy. The war was over, but she was nervous about the mission anyway. The fleet was going to be farther from home than any ships had ventured since the Cataclysm, too far to get any kind of help from the Confederation if something, anything, went badly wrong. Fritz was a hard taskmaster. She knew that. She also knew her teams had come up with a variety of nicknames for her over the years. She'd heard some, but she didn't doubt there were more of them out there. She didn't really care, especially since her people had always given her their best, however much they grumbled when they thought she wasn't listening. She figured letting them blow off steam was helpful. She worked her people hard, and they needed some stress relief. A few of the names were even fairly clever.
"Captain, my people are ready to meet any challenge you put before them."
She held back a smile. She was about to let him off the hook, tell him there would be no surprise exercises, but then the doubt she'd been feeling surfaced again. She considered herself as battle-hardened as it was possible to become, but the unknown was terrifying in ways beyond even the hardship of battle. Baron had given her as much freighter space as he could for spare parts and the like, and she'd racked her brain, trying to come up with anything she might require. If she needed something 50 transits from home and she hadn't brought it, she was screwed. She was also unsettled about her job. Baron had made her chief engineer of the fleet, which made all sorts of sense superficially. But she wasn't exactly sure what a fleet engineer did. She was used to working as ship's innards, tracking down damage and problems. Now she had an office and a big desk near Dauntless's bridge, and a far hazier picture of just what she was supposed to be doing.
"Well, we'll just see how ready you are."
She pulled a tablet from a clip at her waist. "Scenario G4, she said, looking down at the small screen. She almost felt bad. She designed the simulated damage routines herself, and she'd filled them with tricks, engineering complexities guaranteed to drive Billings and his people crazy. There wasn't a straightforward drill in the group. And G4 was one of the worst.
"We're ready, Captain." Billings sounded confident. "Good. We'll see if that lasts."
"I don't even know why I'm here. There are no enemies out there. What does this fleet need with 800 fighters?
Jake Stockton was lying in bed, staring up at the ceiling as he'd been doing for the past few hours. He'd never slept very well, but now he simply had too many nightmares waiting for him, too many shadowy faces of friends gone, men and women burned alive in their fighters or blown to atoms deep in space. The price of sleep was just too high. He'd been as quiet and still as he'd been able to manage as he counted down the minutes until morning.
There was no point in waking up Star just because of his own insomnia. But now he could hear her stirring, and he knew she was awake.
How can anyone know what we're going to need? Nobody's ever done anything like this before. We'll certainly have more than enough scouting duty for the squadrons.
Star Sinclair was awake, but it was clear from her tone she was barely awake. Scouting missions, yes, but we've got 2/3 of the crack squadrons in the fleet with us. 100 ships could handle routine sweeps, certainly 200, and prowling around empty systems doesn't require a pack of aces with 20 kills apiece.
Well, I'd wager the fleet's as big as it is, as much because some of the higher-ups want to protect a portion of the fleet from the downsizing going on. It's hard for even a pacifist senator to argue that we don't need to take old tech more seriously than before, and the fleet is a place to stash ships that will be outside the cost cutter's reach. I'm sure that's true for the squadrons, too.
She paused, putting her hand over her mouth to cover a yawn.
And I'm glad you're here, because I'm here.
Would you really like to go a year or more without seeing me?
There was a playful tone to her words, but Stockton took them to heart.
Star had moved into his quarters more or less completely, if unofficially. It was a scenario that would have terrified the younger Stockton in a way no enemy gunning for him ever had, but now he realized he was not only happy to have her there, he was uncomfortable when she wasn't around. Stockton was one of the Navy's most renowned officers, and no one would say he couldn't face whatever came at him by himself. But he was well aware of the scars he carried now. War, especially the way he fought it, left its marks in more ways than one, and Star's presence helped. She calmed him, softened the screams of the dead.
No, I wouldn't want to go a year without seeing you, but maybe we both should be back on Megara, or at Grimaldi.
Would you really want Admiral Baron to go on this journey without you?
I don't believe that, not for a minute. I just think you like to complain.
She grabbed one of the pillows and gently hit him with it. Then she got up and walked over toward the small head.
I'd love to sit here and listen to you complain, my dear, but unlike you, I've got work to do. I'm on duty in 30 minutes.
She slipped through the small doorway, and he heard the shower come on. He knew she wasn't kidding about having work to do. Star had run the old Dauntless's flight operations during the last few years of the war, but Admiral Baron had since promoted her. She was now the fleet small craft operations officer, which made her responsible for not only the massed fighter squadrons, but also the enormous array of shuttles, gigs, and pinnaces locked in the landing bays waiting to explore any intriguing worlds the expedition found. It was a massive job, and while his as fleet flight commander was no less vast, it was far less likely to come into play. His squadrons would pull long-range patrols, and likely they would make their first sweeps over any dead Imperial worlds. But that was nothing to Stockton's battle-hardened sensibilities, and he wondered if he'd have to program his AI to keep him awake in the cockpit. Stockton slid out of bed. His own duty period didn't begin for a few hours, but his chances of getting any more sleep were nil, so he figured he might as well get up. He looked around the cabin. It wasn't exactly large, not by planet-side standards at least, but it was nearly double the size of his cramped quarters on the old Dauntless. The new ship was magnificent by any standards, yet he found himself missing the old Dauntless and her dingy gray corridors. He'd walked those hallways for 7 years, alongside friends and colleagues he'd never forget. The truth was, he felt lost. The pressure of combat was gone, and now he had far too much time to think about the losses suffered in the war, the comrades he'd lost. He'd almost resigned his commission, but he had no idea what else he could do, and in the end he couldn't leave Stara. Perhaps he could have persuaded her to retire with him, but he hadn't been able to bring himself to suggest it, not when he had no idea where they would go or what they would do. He took a deep breath and stood up, walking over toward the small built-in console. He tossed his jacket there the night before. His eyes went right to the insignia, to the 4 platinum circlets on the collar. Captain. It was a rank he'd never expected to attain, one that seemed almost out of reach for a wildcat pilot like himself. He knew he'd earned it, at least on one level. He'd fought hard during the war, and he'd been in the center of the conflict's greatest battles. But it troubled him, too. He'd had a hard enough time stepping into Kyle Jameson's shoes, assuming the rank his old commander had held. Now he'd reached a level his friend, and to a great extent his mentor, had never held. He realized he had to go on, to accept the deaths of Jameson and so many other friends. He had to do it for Stara, and because Kyle and his other lost comrades would have wanted him to. He knew what he had to do. He just didn't know how to do it.
Chapter 6. Pamphlet posted outside Factory 19A6.
Workers of Baru, there have been several instances of disorder and work stoppages at factories around the city. This disloyalty was instigated by dissident groups, criminals seeking to stand in the way of the revolution. This morning, 63 of these traitors were executed in Freedom Square. The revolution is yours, fellow citizens, and we can tolerate no interference from those seeking to further their own interests at the expense of Baru's workers. We will show no mercy to those who oppose the revolution. Those who fight must be destroyed. Our cause is righteous, and the future is ours.
Remy Caron, First Protector of the People. Baru City, capital of the Baru People's Republic. Baru Rion 3. Union Year 219, 315 AC.
First Protector Caron, I'm pleased to meet you at last. I'm afraid we had some difficulty getting past the Union forces blockading Baru.
Mike Hoover stood in front of a massive desk, looking at the man who, at least if the intel had been accurate, had become the effective ruler of the planet. Hoover glanced around the room, hiding a surprise at what he saw. Caron wore a well-tailored suit, and his office was plushly decorated. Everyone present was well-dressed. He had expected to see a group of factory workers, rough-edged men and women who'd launched a bid to free themselves from their oppressors. All the intel reports and propaganda he'd seen had suggested that Baru's revolutionaries had established an egalitarian socialist republic, but the people in the room with him now looked almost like aristocrats. It didn't take them long to forget where they came from.
It's a pleasure to meet you as well, Mr. Hoover. Words cannot express our gratitude for the help our friends in the Confederation have sent us.
Caron's voice had an edge, an arrogance that hadn't been there earlier, in the days when he'd been just a factory worker caught up in the revolution.
I don't represent the Confederation, First Protector. What an idiotic title. I'm here at the behest of private benefactors who wish to remain anonymous. You and your brave revolution have many admirers, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Hoover sounded sincere, though every word he'd just spoken was a lie. He'd been sent to Baru by none other than Gary Holston. The technical data and supplies he'd brought had come straight from Confederation intelligence. The purpose of this mission was aiding the revolution, keeping the fragile Union off balance. It was second in importance only to the number one priority, hiding any Confederation involvement.
Of course, Mr. Hoover, my apologies.
From Caron's tone, it didn't sound like he apologized frequently. Hoover nodded. There was no one in the room for whom he needed to maintain the charade, but he did it anyway. Openly aiding a combatant engaged in a conflict with a nation was an act of war. It was unlikely the Union could do anything about that right now. They simply weren't in the condition to contemplate a renewal of hostilities with the Confederation. If he fell into Union hands, he was as good as dead. And from the looks of this blood-soaked revolution, he could imagine the dangers right there on Baru. No. Hoover was smart enough to know that the true danger was the Senate, and the apoplectic fit they would throw if they knew what Holston was up to in the Union. What really made him edgy was ending up back on Megara, testifying before a Senate committee looking to lock him up in some deep dark hole and throw away the key.
I've brought you technical specifications, First Protector. Plans that will allow you to convert some of your manufacturing facilities to weapons production. My ship's cargo hold contains rare elements and other difficult-to-obtain items, but fortunately, Baru is a planet rich in both resources and factory operations. Given the technology and the assistance of the experts I brought with me, I believe we can help you fortify your world sufficiently to ward off any attempt the Union might make to invade.
My thanks again to you, from myself and on behalf of the citizens of Baru. We are ready to fight to the end for our freedom. Yet we face an enemy of great power, and your assistance is key to our final victory. We will begin production of the weapons at once. We have already repelled two Union attempts to invade. I fear the next one will be stronger. The plans and technology you bring will be of great value.
Hoover nodded.
I have several experts with me who can help you with retooling your production facilities, but what we brought in the way of materials may be the last we're able to get to you for some time. The Union blockade is still somewhat porous, but it appears they're increasing the strength deployed to your system. I have a series of additional ships coming, but it's far from clear whether they will be able to get through.
or if they will even try. The delicacy and secrecy of the mission prevented Hoover from using naval vessels. He had to recruit a group of rogues and scoundrels from along the frontier, ex-smugglers mostly, and perhaps a few not that ex, who'd been enticed by the sums he'd been prepared to pay for what he had to admit was a very dangerous run. He was confident his compatriots would at least try to complete their trips to Beru, mostly because he'd assured them all that Confederation intelligence would track down any who didn't, but he was equally sure none of them would dive headlong into the Union blockading forces. If they didn't have a clear run, they'd bolt.
"Again, Mr. Hoover, your aid is appreciated. We'll hope for the best with your additional ships. Meanwhile, we will proceed with the production efforts."
He paused. Then he turned toward a woman sitting next to him.
"Citizen Delacorte, would you show our guests to their lodgings?"
"Of course, First Protector."
She stood up and turned toward Hoover. She was young, no older than her late 20s. Her hair was short, a spiky cut that matched the angular shape of her face.
"If you will follow me."
Her voice was pleasant enough, but Hoover felt something odd looking at her, and he suppressed a chill. "Thank you, First Protector, Citizen Delacorte." Hoover turned and glanced back at his comrades. Then he followed Delacorte out of the room, the others right behind him.
"Mr. Hoover, my name is Henri Bernard."
The man was dressed in a rough shirt and pants, both in drab gray, torn in places and stained from long use.
"Thank you so much for meeting with me."
Hoover looked around, not because I particularly thought anyone was watching, but because it was in his nature to assume that might be the case at all times. That caution had saved his life more than once, and Beru was proving to be a surprisingly complicated mission. Hoover had expected danger, but he'd imagined almost all of that would be centered on sneaking to and from the planet. Now he felt hazards all around.
"We're alone here," Bernard said, before Hoover could answer. "This is one of our safe houses."
Hoover realized Bernard had noticed his concern. He was impressed. He developed a cool demeanor in his years as a spy, and the fact that this man had caught his concern suggested he was no ordinary factory worker. Hoover nodded, but he still looked around. In the field, the only eyes he trusted were his own.
"My associate seemed to feel I would want to hear what you had to say."
Hoover had three other agents with him, and he was still stunned Bernard had been able to intrigue Sylvia Breen enough to convince her to set up the meeting. Breen was his number two on the mission, and one of the most stone-cold, cynical agents he'd ever known. The fact that Bernard had gotten to her spoke volumes about the man and his story. "I suggest you get to the point, Mr. Bernard. This may be a safe house, but from what I've seen, there are eyes everywhere on Beru."
"You're right, of course, Mr. Hoover."
A nervous pause.
"I represent the resistance on Beru, the real resistance."
"I don't understand." But in the pit of his stomach, he did.
"The revolution has been hijacked, Mr. Hoover. Our people's desperate lunge for freedom has been taken over by corrupt leaders, no better than those of the Union."
Another pause.
"In some ways, worse."
"So your group is fighting against the current government, the one that replaced the Union authorities?"
"Yes. You met with Caron. Sorry. First Protector Caron. I'm sure he told you how many died heroically fighting the government forces and repelling the Union's attempts to invade. Did he tell you how many his government has murdered?"
Hoover could feel a headache building. He'd gotten a somewhat of a bad impression from the first meeting with Caron, but there was no arguing the man was in firm control right now. Whoever Henri Bernard was, and whatever people he represented, they didn't seem to be remotely close to overthrowing Caron. "No, we didn't discuss such specifics. Are we talking about Union functionaries killed after the revolution?"
"No, Mr. Hoover. There's no doubt that many government officials were slain following the original uprising. But I'm talking about citizens of Beru, many of whom were in the streets on that first night, risking everything to free this world. It began with Caron's political rivals, the other leaders of the revolution, anyone who stood in the way of his seizing absolute power. But then it spread. Any who spoke against his decrees, and anyone associated with those victims, friends, families, co-workers. Then it got worse. Seemingly random mass murders. Enforced relocations. Whole populations moved, some out into the countryside, to the farms and mines. Olemi Kaon was an honest man when the revolution began. I still believe that. But he was corrupted by the power and by that monster, Delacorte.
Ami Delacorte? Hoover had gotten a bad feeling from the revolutionary leader, even in the brief time it had taken her to show them to their rooms. But if what Bernard was telling him was true.
She has his ear. Their lovers and their ambitions feed off each other's. I believe she's the true planner behind what has happened.
Hoover listened, skeptical as always. Are you sure you're not exaggerating? After all, there was lasting resentment toward the old government. Some overreaction to suspected Union leanings, while not admirable, wouldn't be incomprehensible. And whatever relationship Delacorte has with Caron, it's difficult to believe what you're telling me.
I'm not exaggerating, Mr. Hoover. That's why I took the risk of contacting your comrade. Do you know what would have happened to me if she'd turned me into Caron's people? What would have happened to my family? Delacorte would torture my children in front of me, Mr. Hoover. She's evil in a way I cannot even describe.
Bernard's composure was beginning to fracture. Very well, Mr. Bernard. For the moment, let's assume all you have told me is true. Hoover paused. In spite of his cynical nature, something told him what he was hearing was the truth. What do you expect me to do?
You represent the Confederation. You're the bastion of freedom in the galaxy. The Union authorities lied about you all the time, painting your people as monsters who would nuke our worlds into submission if they were able to defeat our fleets. But some of us refused to believe such lies. We waited and hoped you would win the war, that your forces would liberate us. Our hearts sank when word of the peace treaty reached us. But then you came here. We need your help now, perhaps more than ever. Please, Mr. Hoover, you must do something.
Wait a minute, Mr. Bernard. I understand everything you've told me, and if even half of it's true, it's an outrage. But I don't represent the Confederation. I don't have any military forces here, nor any way to get them so deep into Union space. He took a deep breath, wondering if he looked as uncomfortable as he felt. There's nothing I can do. I'm sorry. I'm only here to help fortify Baru so it can repel the next Union assault. That's the extent of my authorization and of my resources.
You must. You have to help us. You cannot support a regime like Caron's. That's not what your people stand for. Please, help us.
Hoover just shook his head, trying to ignore the guilt growing inside him. His mission had nothing to do with a government that controlled a free Baru. He was there to help the rebels defend themselves, whoever was in charge. It was all part of Gary Holston's campaign to slow Gaston Villeneuve from re-establishing the Union's strength and power. He wasn't there to help the people of Baru at all, beyond keeping the Foot Rouge out. The whole truth was even worse. He suspected Baru would eventually be reconquered by the Union despite his efforts. So he wasn't even there to save the planet and its people. He had come to use them, to ensure that the Union expended the maximum resources in re-establishing control. Mr. Bernard. Hoover didn't know what to say to the man, especially after his impassioned remarks about the Confederation and its ideals. He was there to put a thorn in the Union's side, no more. He had not come to bring freedom to anyone. And yet a cold feeling spread through his gut, one that told him everything Bernard had said was horribly true. Worse, it didn't change his mission one bit. If he had to support a pack of bloodthirsty monsters in order to defend Baru from Union attacks, that was just what he had to do.
I'm sorry.
It was miserably inadequate, but it was all he had.
Chapter 7. Deep in the Z4 system. 20 million kilometers from CFS Dauntless. Year 315 AC. Stockton eased up on the throttle, letting the thrust fall back from a soul-killing 10G to a more tolerable 3G. He wasn't sure why he'd driven his fighter so hard on such a routine flight, or for that matter the three other pilots in the patrol. Well, maybe he did. At least to an extent. He'd taken three rookies out with him. He didn't have many noobs in his fighter force, but he was determined to do all he could to reduce that number to dead zero. He'd seen hundreds of pilots fresh from the academy arrive at the front, all full of piss and vinegar, but short on actual experience, and he'd watched far too many of them get themselves killed on their first missions. He couldn't see how his people were going to see any combat on the White Fleet's expedition, but a puppy pilot could get into trouble on scouting duty as well. Giving them a hard run or two could only prepare them for whatever lay ahead. He wondered for an instant why fresh meat like the three rookies brought out his sadistic streak, but then he realized he knew the answer. Stockton believed that most useful lessons came from negative reinforcement. Certainly, that had been his experience. Satisfaction and success were pleasurable, but easily forgotten. The experiences that fueled his nightmares had made him into the pilot he was, and probably saved his life more than once. Squeezing his new pilots at 10G, like fresh oranges in the juicer, was a way to get their attention. Plenty of people would pat them on the back and congratulate them on getting through the academy, but not him. They might hate him by the time he was done, but if he saved one of their lives, it would be worth it. He was going to do whatever he had to do to prevent them from joining the parade of shadowy faces that plagued his sleep. But that wasn't the main reason he was out on the patrol. It got him out from behind a desk and back into the cockpit where he belonged. He was the fleet strike force commander, and his steady updraft and rank over the past few years had finally reached the point where it removed him from duties like routine patrols. At least in theory. He might be expected to man his ship and launch in a full battle fleet when every squadron scrambled, but short of that unlikely eventuality, his time in the vast openness of space was sharply limited these days. Dauntless's vast corridors had begun to feel like a prison already, and by the time the fleet was 10 transits from the Confederation border, he'd started to think he was going crazy. Now, over 4 months and 40 transits into the expedition, he might still be hanging on, but he could also feel the thread getting thinner and thinner. He had to get out, to climb into the cockpit and try to recapture the spirit he felt slipping away. Training some of the new pilots was just the excuse he needed to justify assigning himself to a patrol. "How are y'all doing?" He spoke into the comm, not even trying to keep the smile from his face. He remembered the first time he'd pulled 10G and the first time he'd been this far from base. That kind of discomfort and fear tended to plant themselves in one's mind immutably. "Fine, sir. I'm good, Captain. Here, sir." None of them sounded very good, but they were all trying, and that was the spirit Stockton liked to see in his pilots. They deserved a little break, but just a little one. He had something else in mind, something that would give his wet-behind-the-ears flyer something to think about when they got back to Dauntless. "Relax for a few minutes, stretch out, get loose, because we're going to run some exercises while we're out here. Set your lasers at 0.1% power, just enough to ding a scanner. Then the three of you are going to try to take me down." A wicked grin slipped onto his face. "Before I get you." "Status, Captain?" Baron walked across Dauntless's massive command center. He thought of it as the bridge, of course, regardless of what the ship's designers had decided to designate it. But he also realized it was so much more. The ship was commanded from its confines, but so was the entire fleet. Its main display was more than double the size of the huge 3D setup on the old Dauntless, and there were two more of them on the new ship. They flanked the main display, allowing the officers present to focus on multiple areas of the system at once. It was all very impressive, even a little intimidating, but it seemed a little overkill, especially for an exploration mission. "Everything green, sir. All ships report normal operations. No new contacts." The fleet had encountered a few excavation sites while they were still in the explored areas of the Badlands, spots where previous expeditions had looked for, and likely, at least in some cases, found bits of old tech. But that was to be expected, and from all the reports Baron had seen to date, the current system was devoid of anything save a few gas giants orbiting far from the primary. There had no doubt been other planets along the fleet's path with useful artifacts waiting to be found, but Baron's mission wasn't to nudge the charted areas of the Badlands out another dozen systems. It was to push deep into the unknown, seeking larger caches of ancient technology closer to the old Empire's ancient core, as well as discovering some clues to the cause and nature of the cataclysm. "Any word from the patrol?"
"Routine status check."
Travis looked down at the readings on her screen.
21 minutes ago, the patrol has exceeded its coverage area, there at the very edge of all detection range near the innermost planet."
"Stockton?"
"Yes, sir." "Apparently, he reshuffled the patrol roster again and took out three of the rookie pilots."
Something between a snort and a laugh escaped Baron's lips. He was more amused than annoyed at Stockton's restlessness, and the fact that the pilot thought he was fooling anybody. That's the third time?
Fourth, sir.
Baron wasn't surprised. Jake Stockton had never been an easy officer to command or to control. He'd have ended up booted from the service long ago or even in the brig, save for one thing. He was that good. Stockton was one of the three or four officers who can actually lay a claim to having been individually vital to victory in the last war. The man was moody, irritable at times, and in many ways he was like his own worst enemy. But Baron had never seen anyone else who could fly a lightning-class fighter like the legendary Raptor. No, that's not true. There was one other. Jovi Gracchus. But Gracchus was gone. She had died in the final battle of the war, another of those officers without whom victory would have been impossible. She had sacrificed herself to save Dauntless, opening the way for the doomed battleship to ram the Pulsar, and ending the chances the Union could continue the war. Baron shook his head as he remembered Gracchus. She hadn't been killed in the battle itself. She ran out of fuel and froze to death before the rescue ships could reach her. That didn't make her act any less heroic in his estimation, but he knew in the strange realm of Alliance culture, dying in such a way was considered somewhat shameful. It didn't make any sense, not to him at least, but then for all the time he'd fought at their sides, he had never come to fully understand the Palatians. Still one of the tenets of their culture and the somewhat mysterious way they all followed, it seemed terribly wrong that her last thoughts had likely been ones of shame. Well, Captain Stockton was moved up pretty abruptly in his responsibilities, Baron said finally. I think we need to give him some room. He'll figure out how to adapt to his new duties, and it can't hurt morale for these new pilots to see the great Raptor flying next to them. At least they're a lot less likely to run into any combat out here. Baron didn't think the fleet would see any fighting at all, unless they ran into a rogue adventurer or some ancient but still operational automated defense system. No random smuggler could pose a serious risk to the fleet, of course, though the thought of some Imperial fortress still functioning under computer control gave him pause. Still, even though he didn't expect to see any major combat, that didn't mean the mission wasn't dangerous. Even his war-hardened nerves were a little on edge as each transit took his people farther and farther into the unknown.
That was good. You guys did well.
Stockton knew the psyche of a young fighter pilot well enough to realize that none of them saw things that way. All three of them had come at him at different angles, blasting hard. If they'd been after one of their academy classmates, the fight would have been over in seconds. But they were chasing the fleet's premier pilot, a veteran of most of the major battles of the war. Jake Stockton had faced off against enemy aces and packs of fighters that outnumbered him 5 or 10 to 1. He'd led desperate assault forces, including the one that knocked out the Pulsar's power supply in the bottleneck. Coming out on top in the impromptu exercise he'd put together for his rookies had been almost comically easy. He'd changed his thrust vector almost randomly, pulling his ship away from the incoming attack. Then he spun around, targeting the closest of his attackers and scoring a simulated hit the AI deemed sufficient to classify the fighter as destroyed. After that, his killer instinct kicked in. His remaining two opponents were surprised, shocked at the death of their comrade. And the reactions slowed. Just for an instant, but against a pilot like Jake Stockton, that was enough. He'd brought his ship around, firing his engines at full and coming up on his second target. His intended victim reacted, or at least tried to, burning his engines and trying to get out of Stockton's targeting arc. But he had been too late. Stockton's third shot was a hit and another simulated kill. That had made the fight one-on-one, an almost absurdly easy matchup for Stockton. He had even held back his fire to give the pilot a chance to escape. But that only prolonged the exchange for another half a minute. Then Stockton's finger had tightened and the trace power of his lasers had hit the target sensors, causing the AI to declare a third and final kill.
Seriously, he added after his despondent opponents remained silent. I've been out here a lot longer than any of you, and I've seen things I hope none of you ever has to see. I don't give out unearned praise. Y'all did very well. I'm proud of...
His voice stopped abruptly as his eyes caught something. His long-range scanner alarm was blinking. He reached out and punched at the controls, directing the scanning beams to converge on the signal. The last thing he'd expected was some kind of contact all the way out here. He punched at the keys on his panel, directing the AI to start crunching the incoming data.
Captain?
It was one of the pilots, Grissom, he realized after a brief delay.
I'm fine, he responded, his voice a little sharper than he'd intended. You guys just stay put for a minute. He turned his attention back to the scanning data. Whatever he was reading, and he had no idea what it was, beyond a strange energy source, it was coming from the vicinity of the nearby gas giant. He'd come a long way, at least 4 million kilometers past the patrol's stated range, and the planet was another few kilometers out. His gut told him he had enough fuel, just, for a run out there and a quick pass to gather closer range data. It would be tight, and nothing he wanted his young pups involved with, but he figured he could manage it. I want all of you to fly back to Dauntless and land. I'll be there soon. Captain, we can't leave you out here, not this far from a mothership. It was Grissom again, and Stockton almost snapped at him to obey orders. But he held his tongue. The kid was right, and the regs were on his side. The almighty book yet again. And something more than that. The pilot's urge not to abandon a comrade was commendable, and Stockton didn't want to override that. All right, but I want you all to remain where you are. Decelerate to bring yourselves to a dead stop and stay there. If any of you follow me, I swear to God you'll be in a spacesuit scraping residue off Dauntless's hull instead of flying a fighter. Understood? He got three nervous versions of yes, sir, or words to that effect. Then he glanced back at the small screen on the dashboard, and he kicked in his thrusters. It was probably nothing, but he was still edgy. They passed through nothing but long-dead systems for weeks, without a trace reading of artificial energy output. Until now. Chapter 8. The Promenade. Spacer's District. Port Royal City, Planet Danif, Ventica 3. 315 AC. Andy LaFarge moved down the wide stone walkway, her eyes darting back and forth at the seedy bars and cheap restaurants that lined the promenade. There were copies of the Spacer's District on half a dozen border planets, but none quite matched Port Royal City, for either activity or sleaziness. The planet, Danif, was a hotbed of rumor about old tech. Most of the information sold in the taverns and brothels were lies, but Andy knew from experience that some nuggets of truth made their way through the heavy layer of fraud. She had found or bought, usually bought, more than one solid lead in these grungy holes in the wall. Most had been modest scores, broken bits of marginal equipment that were valuable enough to pay for an expedition and turn a tidy profit. She never thought she'd see the place again, and it troubled her slightly that it felt almost like home to her. She'd never imagined herself as a Badlands captain for the rest of her life. She'd always considered her chosen profession as the means to an end. But she couldn't deny the relief she'd felt as she sat in the captain's chair on Pegasus's bridge. Her beloved ship had felt like home, and she was still struggling to explain to herself how she could possibly have been more comfortable in her cramped cabin than she'd been in the palatial villa. It didn't make sense, and part of her wanted to deny it. She didn't want to crave this life. But something about it felt normal. One other thing that seemed right, something she hadn't realized how much she'd missed, was the pistol slung around her waist. It hung low on the one side, just the way she liked it, and though it had been more than 2 years since she'd drawn it in anger, somehow she knew she was as fast as ever. She wondered if Holston had really expected to convince her when he'd come to Tellurus. The whole idea seemed absurd. She was a wealthy woman now, one who could buy virtually anything she wanted, indulge in any kind of luxury she could imagine. And yet he'd convinced her to return to the grunge of the border, to the dark, dangerous, and sleazy world from which she'd extricated herself after years of work and struggle. It hadn't even been difficult. The instant he'd put the idea in her head, he'd had her. The boredom, the frustration, the feeling of being lost that had taken her as she puttered around her giant house— had all conspired to do his job for her. She'd been determined to make a go of it in her new life, even if it drove her mad, at least until Holston had opened another door for her, given her an excuse to escape. Her eyes darted back and forth, from one sign to another. Some of the establishments she remembered were still there, others had changed hands or names. She wondered how many of her old contacts were still there. She'd known a few who'd prowled Danith Spacer's district for decades, but in most cases a career as a purveyor of Badlands rumors was a short one. Some made a killing and vanished, to a life much like the one she had just abandoned. Others ended up on the floor of one of the taverns, gunned down by some free trader's crew he'd swindled. Even those who escaped such an end tended to get worn down quickly. the danger, the constant intrigue. They were a heavy burden that few could carry for long. She slipped inside the Green Star. It wasn't bad as Spacer's district bars went, at least not to the eyes. The floor was reasonably clean, and if things were still the same as she remembered, they didn't water down the drinks. Not too much, at least. That didn't make the place safe, and Andy knew it had seen its share of bodies hauled off after one dispute or another. She'd even watched a few of those fights. But the Green Star had also been the headquarters of one of her most reliable contacts, and she decided to seek him out first to see if he was still in business. Drake Trencher would have at least some information on any prominent leads making the rounds, and he'd probably have a good idea of any recent Sector 9 activity along the border as well. She scanned the room. It was early afternoon, and the place was almost empty. Most of the port's denizens were probably still sleeping off the debauchery of the night before. But Trencher wasn't like the others. He was a cut above, and she figured there was a chance he would be there. He owned the place, after all, though few people knew that. She walked toward the back, looking at the table where Trencher had held court back during her days on Daneth. The red leather-upholstered booth was empty, so she sat at a nearby table, and she waited. She wasn't sure what reception she'd get, assuming he showed up at all. They'd worked together more than once, successfully, too. But Drake Trencher had never been above making an exclusive deal and then selling the information to two or three other parties. And that kind of thing had always brought out Andy's ornery side. For all the time she had shared a good payday with him, he'd also seen the business end of her pistol more than once. She wondered which times he would remember when he set eyes on her. Her old confidence had come back quickly, with one small change. She'd always had her crew with her before. Having backup waiting in the wings was no guarantee of not getting shot or stabbed when a deal went bad, but it was a damn sight better than nothing. Holston had told her to wait until he arrived before she started poking around looking for information. But then she'd never been all that good at taking directions. What'll it be? The Green Star was a nice place, at least in comparison to its competition along the promenade, but that didn't mean they wouldn't bounce her for sitting and not ordering anything. I'll have a silver ale. She'd never been a big drinker, though doing business in the Spacer's district usually required at least putting on a show. She developed a dozen ways to spill half a drink without being noticed, but it was early enough that she wouldn't draw any attention to herself if she wasn't pounding down double shots. Coming right up. The server was a gruff-looking man. The Green Star was famous for its women, both the scantily clad ones serving drinks and the even less dressed ones waiting in the rooms upstairs. But the earliness of the day was in full force, and the normal denizens of the evening were nowhere to be seen. Andy watched as the waiter walked back to the table and put the mug down in front of her. He paused for a few seconds, but she just glanced up at him and said, "Run me a tab." He hesitated for a few seconds, clearly concerned that he'd never seen her before and wondering if she intended to stiff him. But she watched his eyes drop to the pistol at her side, and then he just nodded and walked away. She sipped at the ale slowly, drinking hardly any, looking around the room. She watched a man and a woman at the bar whispering to each other and looking her way. They were trying to appear unobtrusive, but they were failing badly. She didn't respond or give any hint she had noticed. After all, she was there to be seen. Finding Trencher was a needless effort, at least when she could just sit there and let him find her. She had enough of a reputation on the border, even with a shroud of secrecy that surrounded her greatest find, that word of her return would spread. The woman slipped through a door behind the bar, and the man stepped forward, trying to look like he was wiping the counter down, while his eyes darted her way every few seconds. She reached out and picked up the mug, taking another small drink. She really just wanted water, but she knew better than to order that in any Spacer's bar. Aside from the advantages of fitting in with the drinking culture so prevalent on the border, she could barely imagine the assortment of pathogens and whatever nasty-ass water ran through the Green Star's pipes. A little alcohol was helpful as an antiseptic, if nothing else. "Andy Lafarge, it's been quite some time since you graced my establishment with your presence." She turned her head and looked up. "How have you been, Drake?" He'd seemed to come out of nowhere, but Andy remembered the Green Star well enough to know the place had more than one unobtrusive door leading out from the back areas. She gestured toward the bar. "Your people have dropped off some since I was here last. They might as well have stared over here with binoculars." "Well, you know how hard it is to get good help." He put his hand on the back of the booth. "Mind if I sit?" His eyes flashed down, checking out the gun at her side. "It's your place." She waved toward the empty seat. He nodded and slid onto the seat opposite her. Like I said, it's been a long time. Rumor has it you had a big find. A retirement score. I'd wager there are rumors around here that I have two heads, Drake. You can't believe everything you hear.
I don't believe anything, Andy. You must remember that much, at least.
I remember everything. She grabbed her mug and took another drink.
Still, you've been gone for almost 2 years now. There must be some truth to the stories.
She smiled. We did okay, Drake. A good run, better than most. Enough for one hell of a time, and I've still got a good amount of it tucked away. But you know as well as I do, it takes a lot to live the lifestyle.
She was tense. It had been a long time since she'd interacted with border lowlifes like Trencher, and she was second-guessing every word that came out of her mouth. But she felt alive, too, in a way she hadn't all those months, prowling around her villa.
What about your people? I haven't seen any of them around here. I can't remember the last time I ran into you without Vig Merrick lurking nearby.
She hesitated before replying.
Vig and I had a disagreement, I'm afraid. Last I heard, he was out near the rim. He bought a place on some two-bit agricultural planet and settled down. As far as I know, the others are all still out there burning through their bankrolls.
She looked over at Trencher and smiled.
I have more expensive tastes than most of them. And besides, I want to make damn sure I have enough to last. I don't want to end up back here when I'm 60, scavenging around for a score to keep me going.
Well, whatever's behind it, it's good to have you back here, Andy. There's nobody working Danith now as good as you are, that's for damn sure.
Is that your way of telling me you want to work together? Because if you've got any good data, I'm ready to listen.
She wondered if that had been too direct. After all, she was sitting there, without a crew, not exactly ready to blast off chasing down a hot lead.
I might have something in the works, Andy. Why don't you get your act together and then we'll talk? You'll need a new crew, I guess. By the time you've got that in place and you're ready to go, I should have something worth talking about.
He looked across the table, locking eyes with her.
Sound good? She had the ale in her hand and she took another drink. Then she set it down and nodded.
Sounds good, Drake.
She paused. Say, a week? I don't think I'll need any more time than that. I've got some good prospects to crew up Pegasus. Just a matter of picking the ones I want.
A week it is, then.
He slid out of the booth and stood up.
1 week.
He smiled.
It's good to have you back, Andy. Let's make some money, eh?
That's why I'm here, Drake.
Well, you're already in the black. That drink's on me, and as many more as you want.
He flashed a sign to the bartender, who nodded his acknowledgement.
That's a change. Can't say I remember you giving anything away before. Getting soft in your old age?
He took a step from the booth, and then he turned and looked down at her.
Let's just say I'm a sentimental sort, and I'm glad to see an old friend. 1 week from now, right here.
He smiled again, and then he walked across the room and slipped through the door behind the bar.
Chapter 9. Deep in the Z4 system. 24 million kilometers from CFS Dauntless. Year 315 AC. Stockton hit the fighter's controls, decelerating as he approached the planet. He was near enough to have visual contact now, somewhat of a rarity with the vast distances involved in space travel and combat. The planet was a bright, vibrant orange and red, partially obscured by a gauzy lattice of white clouds that wound all around the massive sphere. It was beautiful, almost breathtaking, and he stared at it for a few seconds, appreciating something he rarely noticed. The universe was full of wonders, magnificent sights all around, but to him they had almost always been nothing save small lights on a screen. A planet might be a destination or even potential cover from an approaching attacker, but he hardly ever took the time to appreciate one's magnificence. He didn't think the way he was now very often, his thoughts usually on facts and missions, and especially the dangers that had dogged his work for so long. But being alone so far out, millions of kilometers from the fleet, made him more reflective. The gas giant was large, even by the standards of such things, and he suspected that in its formative days it had come close to becoming a star in its own right. But instead, its mass had just failed to create the chain of fusion reactions needed, and it settled into a deep orbit around the Z4 primary. The glory of life as a star had eluded it, but it hosted its own vast and complex array of satellites. The planet had no less than 41 moons that Stockton's scanners had detected,
Some were little more than scraps of barren rock, while others were almost the size of planets, with atmospheres of their own and varied array of makeups. Several were volcanic nightmares, their surfaces pockmarked with deep craters and geysers of molten rock, while others seemed almost habitable, save perhaps for the low temperature so far from the primary. Stockton cranked up his scanners to full power. The signal had been vague and intermittent when he'd first picked it up, and now he could see why. Between the planet's massive magnetic field and the volcanic activity of the moons, there was a tremendous amount of natural interference. He'd lost the reading a few times on his way in, but his AI had altered the frequencies, adapting to conditions and always managing to get it back fairly quickly. Now, however, this close to the planet, the background radiation and the magnetic fields were near to overwhelming his scanners. He wished his ship had a spread of probes to launch, but a lightning fighter didn't have room for things like that. He thought about pulling out, about heading back to Dauntless and suggesting Admiral Baron initiate an intensive scanning effort. That would delay the fleet's journey and cause a lot of fuss. Still, it was the cautious move and possibly the right call. Probably. But Stockton just wasn't wired that way. He was going in. He angled his thrusters, accelerating softly, heading toward the nearest cluster of moons. The planet was frigidly cold, at least by the standards of human habitability, and if it had any kind of solid ground, it was thousands of kilometers into the dense gaseous outer layers. The gravity that far down would be 1,000 times mega-normal, enough to turn him into something resembling strawberry jam, and that made it very unlikely that anything man-made was on the planet itself. He kept looking back at his screen, watching as more data came in. The energy readings were stronger now, and as he pushed closer toward the planet's orbital track, he began to get better positional readings. He worked through the data, eliminating potential targets one at a time as his fighter moved slowly forward. He was sure now he was picking up some kind of artificial construction. The rhythm was just too regular to be any kind of natural phenomenon. For an instant, he wondered if some frontier prospector had made it out this far, if he'd found the remains of some new kind of salvage operation, or even an active one. That could be dangerous, not so much to the fleet, but to him, alone in a single fighter. The crews that worked the Badlands generally didn't react well to interlopers poking their noses into a new find. He shook his head. No, that was very unlikely. They had run into signs of prospecting activity far closer in, but they'd passed through dozens of systems since the last traces of exploration activity. The fleet was just too far out, and no expedition less provisioned and substantial could possibly have come this distance from support. That realization sent a shiver down his spine. Whatever his scanners were picking up, it hadn't been built by anyone from the Confederation, or the Union or Alliance, or any of the known powers. That energy reading was from some machine constructed by the old Empire centuries before, and it was still functioning. No one would call Jake Stockton a coward, but the idea of an ancient device still operating centuries after those who built it had died was chilling in its own way. He'd seen his share of old tech, even items of great power like the pulsar and stealth generator. But none of those artifacts had been found still functioning. Whatever this was, it was still operating now on its own. That meant whatever fuel powered it had lasted hundreds of years. Its systems had functioned continually with no repairs and no replacements. As far as he knew, nothing like that had ever been discovered in the Badlands. This was the kind of thing the fleet had come to find, of course, but Stockton hadn't imagined stumbling on it himself, alone, far out from the fleet. He knew the potential value of functioning old tech, and the importance of the Confederation finding it before the Union or another malevolent force did. Still, he couldn't shake the feeling that the entire expedition was somehow looking for trouble wandering out this far into unknown space. He tapped the controls again, adjusting his course as the AI tightened the projected location of the contact. He flipped a series of switches, shutting down non-vital systems to free up power for the scanning beams. The dense magnetic activity was playing havoc on his sensors, and the data was crawling in. Even with the power boost, he'd have to get close, very close, to get anything conclusive. His eyes moved over the screen, watching as he approached a small group of three moons situated within 1,000 kilometers of each other. The power source was definitely on, or in orbit around one of them. His ship was coming in slowly. He'd barely tapped his thrust. He didn't have a choice. He was getting very close to the limit of his fuel supply. If he burned his thrusters too hard, he wouldn't have enough power to get back. especially since he'd have to match any acceleration away from the fleet with corresponding deceleration to head back. Coming at Dauntless without enough fuel to decelerate and land was unlikely to be the disaster it could be in a battle situation, but it would be damned humiliating for the Strike Force commander to zip by his mothership and wait for a rescue boat to catch up and dock with him, all in full sight of the fleet. There you are. His eyes focused on a small dot, the closest of the moons. He finally managed to pick out the one he was looking for, and as he got closer, the scanner reports became cleaner, more complete. He crept forward, the cockpit silent, save for his breath and the occasional beep from one of the instruments. His AI was active, recording everything. He would have sent the data back to his comrades for transmission to Dauntless right away, but the magnetic interference had cut off his comm completely. That was annoying, but it didn't seem like a big deal. He could just blast his thrusters and clear the affected area in a minute or two once he'd finished his scanning run. Still, it made him feel even more alone. All right, just a little closer. Then, it's time to pull out and turn this over to the Admiral. His thought was cut off by an energy spike, and then his fighter rocked hard. The alarm began blaring, and he could hear the AI speaking, warning him of system failures. For an instant, he thought he was dead, but then he realized that whatever had happened, his ship had survived. His first thought was that he'd been attacked, and he braced for another shot. But then he realized it had been some kind of scanning beam that had hit him, one vastly more powerful than any he'd been putting out. His instincts took over. Attack or no, whatever that thing was, it was dangerous. It was time to get out, to report this to the fleet and get some backup. He angled his throttle and pulled it back. Nothing. He reached down and flipped a series of switches, rerouting power flow. But the ship still didn't respond. Run a diagnostic, he snapped to the AI. Incoming scanner beam has burned out a large number of electrical systems. Restoration of thrust control impossible without full repairs in dock. Damn. Stockton's hands moved over the panel, checking for himself what the AI had just told him. It wasn't that he didn't trust the computer, not exactly. But he didn't much like the idea of being stranded so far from the fleet, without comm and without engine control. Most of all, he didn't like the fact that he had no idea what had just disabled his ship with nothing more than a scan. The fleet had come looking for old tech, and they had damn sure just found some. But Stockton was more concerned now about getting back to Dauntless than he was about the potential uses of whatever artifact he'd stumbled upon. He stared at his screens, waiting, his stomach clenched tightly by the sudden and unexpected danger. He was helpless, and if the artifact he'd found was truly hostile, if it had weapons of a power commensurate with that scanner beam and programming that directed it to attack, he was as good as dead. He forced himself to take a breath, and then another, and with each passing second he felt his tension ratchet down just a bit. After a minute, perhaps two, he decided whatever was out there, it wasn't going to destroy him. At least not right away. He looked at the screen. His scanners were still operating, at least partially, and information was trickling in. Whatever he'd found, it was in geosynchronous orbit around the moon in front of him. The moon was very planet-like, someplace he imagined might even be pleasant if its temperature had been a little warmer than a chilly 198 absolute. It appeared to have seas, though Stockton recalled enough from his academy classes to realize they were likely filled with methane. Any water, at least on the surface, would be frozen solid. He took another breath, deeper this time, and he exhaled hard. The fact that he was still alive suggested the artifact's primary purpose was scanning and not combat, though it was just possible he'd only been spared because the sensors were still operative and the weapons were not. Or they need longer to charge before they fire. The thing wasn't large, no more than 1,000 tons, but he couldn't get any more specific data. None of his beams could read anything beneath the device's hull, save for the detection of ongoing energy production that had brought him out here in the first place. His fighter had limited scanning ability, and even that was damaged now and operating at reduced effectiveness. Nevertheless, there were no signs of hostile activity, and after another few minutes, his unsettled gut finally agreed with his brain. He leaned back and put his hand to his head, rubbing his throbbing temples. He was beginning to truly believe he wasn't about to get blown to atoms. But it looked like he wasn't going to escape the humiliation of needing to be rescued after all. Now he just hoped his green comrades, waiting 4 million kilometers away, got nervous quickly and called to the fleet for help to arrive, before his life support ran out. Chapter 10 The Promenade Spacer's District Port Royal City Planet Danith Ventica 3 315 AC I reestablished some old contacts, good ones, at least